Thank you very much. So this is a joint work with Rich Schwartz, one of the organizers who is not here, so all mistakes are mine. All pictures are his. This is a byproduct of something else we're doing, and I hope I'll have some time to explain what this bigger and less pictorial project is. This is more or less the content of a commissioned article which will appear in Mathematical Intelligencer, and mostly I'll be showing you pictures. And I need to confess that as we have no idea what we are doing, we discovered eight, perhaps new, hopefully new theorems, similar to very old ones, but we have no idea why they hold. So let me start with old classical theorems of projective geometry. There are three which I want to mention. One is that of Pappus, so this is 1700 years old, roughly. And let me remind you what the theorem says. It says that if you have two lines, this and that, and you pick three points on each line, and then you connect points as shown, then these red lines intersect and give you three new points, blue ones, and the claim is that these three points lie on a new line. That's the Pappus theorem. And there are many other theorems like that, configuration theorems in projective geometry, where you do the very basic things. You pick points, you connect them by lines, you intersect lines, you create new points, and then a surprise awaits you at some point. Either some triple of points belong to the same line, which is not general position situation, so it's a statement, or three lines intersect at one point, which is another statement. And here on the left, you see a theorem of Pascal. So this is 17th century. Very long after Pappus. And this is a generalization. So instead of taking six green points on two lines, we take six green points on a conic, on an ellipse in this picture, and then we connect them the same way, and the same statement holds. The three blue points lie on a line. They are collinear. And then there is a third theorem, that of Brianchon, and this is formally speaking, the same theorem. You just apply projective duality, which I'll mention later. But nevertheless, it took more than 100 years to discover. And this is a theorem saying that if you have a hexagon, which is circumscribed about a conic, here a conic is presented by a circle, and you connect opposite vertices, so there are three lines connecting three long diagonals, then they pass through the same point. These are the three classical theorems, and the ones I'm going to present, like I say, that we have eight different theorems. They all have this same spirit. We start with some polygon. In our theorems, polygons are n-gons with n from 6 to 12, and then we do some basic iterations, connect some vertices, intersect some lines, and as the result, something happens which is not supposed to happen. So let me now comment on the subtitle of my talk, New Wine, Old Wineskins, or Old Wine and New Wineskins. So what I had in mind was the saying of Jesus, which is quoted here. No one puts new wine into old wineskins, otherwise the new wine will burst the skins and will be spilled, and the skins will be destroyed. This saying has many different interpretations, and I'm not going into this at all, but my interpretation of the reversal of this subtitle of my talk, old wine into new wineskins, is that we are dealing with a very old kind of theorems, with configuration theorems, similar to Pappus, but we deal with them using computers, so that's our new wineskins, and I hope computers will not crash, so nothing will burst and spill. Although one of the theorems I'm going to present is not a theorem, formally speaking, because we don't have a proof. it's certainly true, but it's conjecture, formally speaking. All right, so now to the business. We talk about polygons in the projective plane. Projective plane here is a real projective plane, but actually nothing depends on the field. If you like complex projective plane, you're welcome. Finite projective plane as well, probably. But we want to see things, so we draw real pictures. So a polygon is a cyclically ordered collection of points, its vertices, P1 through PN, and the index is cyclic, of course. And polygons also have sides. Sides are, that's a collection of, cyclically ordered collection of lines, and line number I, side number I, connects vertex number I and vertex number I plus 1. We need to consider two copies of projective plane, the original projective plane and its dual projective plane. So projective duality interchanges points and lines. So what is a point on the original plane is a line in the dual one, and what is a line in the original one is a point on the dual one. And this projective duality preserves the incidence relation. So if a point lies a line, then the dual picture will have exactly the same property of the dual line will pass through the dual point. So in this sense, if we have a polygon, we also consider its dual polygon, which is denoted by P star. And this is a polygon in the dual projective plane, and its vertices are the lines, the sides of the original one, and its sides correspond to the vertices of the original one. So this duality of polygons interchanges sides and vertices. And this duality is an involution. If you do it twice, you get back to the original polygon. This is a recollection of something which is very familiar. Okay, now introducing the main characters. We have these two sets. This is supposed to be a script P or calligraphic P. Set of n-gons in the projective plane and set of n-gons in the dual projective plane. For every k, k is also an index which is cyclic, so mod n, we define a natural map, diagonal k diagonal map, from the space of polygons to the space of polygons in the dual plane. Namely, if we have a polygon, you connect every vertex with vertex, every vertex with index I, with vertex with index I plus k, do it for every I, and what you get is a collection, cyclically ordered collection of lines, that is vertices of the polygon in the dual plane, and that's our map. So here is a formal definition. We do it for every k, and for every k, this mapping is an involution. That's an easy exercise, probably you see it already. If you do it twice, you get back to the original polygon. Using this terminology, the projective duality, which I mentioned at the top of the slide, is just T1. You connect every vertex to the next one, that's the side, you treat it as vertex of a dual polygon, that's projective duality. So to formulate theorems, we extend this notation, so Tk, if you compose such maps, what we get, say, Tab is composition of Ta and Tb, Tabc composition of Ta, Tb, Tc, and so on. So that's the notation. Now, the theorems come in two different flavors. The stronger kind of theorem reads as follows. You start with n-gon, n-varies, which is inscribed into a conic. Now, I need to say a few words about conics. So in the projective plane, all non-degenerate conics are the same. They're all related by projective transformations. If you live in projective world, you don't see any difference between conics. They're all as good as a circle. So in this sense, when I say a polygon is inscribed in a conic, it doesn't matter in which conic it's inscribed, they're all the same. So a theorem would say that given an n-gon, n will vary from 6 to 12, and certain sequence of indices, if a polygon is inscribed, then the result of applying this kind of transformation, like T2, then T1, then T2, yields a polygon which is projectively equivalent to the original one. So let's take a look at the first statement. So here we have three theorems. The easiest one, let P be an inscribed hexagon. So this is an illustration, it's not very clear. Can you see this at all? I'll show better pictures soon. So this is an inscribed hexagon. And then we apply T2. So T2 means that we draw short diagonals. We connect every vertex to the one after the next. And this is the side of the new polygon. Well, I want to see the result on the same picture, so I will also apply T1 to get back to the same projective plane. So what you see here is actually this new hexagon is the result of applying T2 and then T1 to get back. And the claim is that the original polygon and this one are projectively dual, or as the formulation says, P and T2 of P are projectively equivalent. So that's the statement. For heptagons, sevengons, a similar formulation. So we start with a sevengon heptagon inscribed into a conic. In all these pictures, conic is presented by a red circle. Like I said, it doesn't matter which shape it is. It has. So we start with a heptagon, which is inscribed, and then we do a more complicated drawing. So we draw short diagonals, then we get back to the initial plane by projective duality, then we draw short diagonals again. So it's depth 2 construction, if you wish. And the result is, again, projectively equivalent heptagon, or if we get back to the same screen, the resulting one, the small one, is projectively dual to the initial one. By the way, the initial one is inscribed, the resulting one is circumscribed, that's duality. That's how it should be. And then a third theorem in this list, octagons, again, the same formulation, but it's still one deeper. As far as number of diagonals we need to consider. So we start with inscribed octagon, we do the short diagonals three times, and the resulting, in this screen, the resulting small octagon is projectively dual to the initial one, or in the original formulation, just projectively equivalent, but on the dual plane. There is an obvious pattern here, T2, T212, T21212, and you would think it continues, but it does not. We don't know why, but that's where it stops. Okay, now, this is a better picture. So this is a, how many, I think it's heptagon, right? It's 7, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, or 8. 8. So this is the third of this theorems illustrated this way, so you clearly see this red diagonals are the short diagonals which you draw and do it three times. Second time and then third time. And the resulting polygon in this picture is exactly dual to the initial one. Soon I'll show you applets which do a better job. But first I want to formulate other theorems. Okay, now the next one concerns nonagons, ninegons. So here the formulation is slightly different. Of course, we can always play this game going to the dual plane if we wish. But in this formulation, we start with a ninegon, which is circumscribed about a conic. So here is our red circle, a conic, and this is the ninegon which circumscribes this. And then we do this iteration. So we draw diagonals which are not shortest one, but which connect vertex I to vertex I plus 3 everywhere. And then we get back to the same plane by duality. Then we do this construction again and get back to the same plane. And the result is a projectively dual nonagon. So here the initial one is circumscribed. The resulting one is inscribed. That's our fourth theorem, although it has number 2, but the first one has 3 statements. Next one, concerning 12-gons, the decagons. By the way, I don't have anything for 11 gons, and I even don't know how to call them, but anyway, they don't appear for some reason. The decagon, 12 gon, again, we start with inscribed as before, and we do a rather long sequence of diagonal drawing, 3-4-3-4 alternating, and the result is, again, the same. This tilde, I didn't say it, means projectively equivalent. And if you draw it in the same screen, then the resulting is projected with dual. So here we start with inscribed inside, and we end up with the circumscribed outside. Okay, so fourth theorem, wrong. So I already gave you five, so the last three. So this is the second flavor. These are weaker theorems. Here we don't claim that the resulting polygon is projectively equivalent to the initial one. We say less, but still a very strong statement. The theorems all state that if an n-gon is inscribed, and then you apply again a series of transformations as before, this diagonal drawing, then the resulting will be circumscribed about a conic. It's still a very strong statement because a general n-gon, unless n is 5 or less, is not inscribed, is not circumscribed. So we're basically saying that many, many quantities vanish. But we don't claim here that the resulting polygon is projectively related somehow, either by duality or by projective transformation to the initial one. So let me read the remaining three. If P is an inscribed octagon, so that's the illustration, red circle and an octagon inscribed, and we do just once this three diagonal drawing, vertex I to vertex I plus 3, then the resulting octagon in the projective, in the dual plane is circumscribed, or if we draw it here, we get back by projective duality, then it's again inscribed. So this picture shows you the original one, which is inscribed, and the resulting one, which is also inscribed. And you clearly see that this resulting one is not projectively equivalent to the initial one. It's not convex, it's very different. But nevertheless, it's inscribed. The next statement, if P is an inscribed decagon, tengon, and here we do 3, 1, 3, then the resulting decagon is circumscribed. So the picture again uses projective duality to draw everything on the same screen, and you see this small one inscribed. And then the last statement, if P is an inscribed the decagon, 12-gon, so here it's the outermost, and we do construction of depth 5, so we draw diagonals of length 3, 1, 3, 1, 3, then the resulting one is circumscribed, or in the screen is inscribed. This last theorem has this little star here, which means that it's not a theorem, it's just a result of computer experiments. We don't have a proof. We have no doubt it's true, but it's not clear whether it's worth our time because our proofs are very stupid proofs, just brute force computation. We hope to find something better, and that's why it's still in this state. Actually, all this is quite new. We discovered the first of this in July, and I think by September we had a complete list. We believe it's complete, but I'll say a few words about that. So this is another illustration. This is a decagon, I believe, 10 sides. So this corresponds to the second of these statements. And the pattern is 3, 1. So indeed, we connect vertex to the one up, which is skipping 2, like this. So we obtain this intermediate black decagon. And then we do it again, and we obtain the resulting one. All right, now let me try to show you applet, which does much better job in illustrating all this. Let's see how to do it. Okay. So this is the heptagon part of it. Here we can move vertices at will. Vertices of the initial one, you see how the terminal one changes. All these applets are posted on Rich's website, so if you want to play with that, it's free domain. This is octagon. Let's see what else we have. Okay, decagon. Now, this is the one which doesn't claim that there is a projective relation. You see that the one inside is very much distorted, and actually I can make it pretty bad if I try. Yeah. All right, this is our pride. When I saw this picture for the first time, I told Richard that maybe this is for tombstone, and he said, no, make a tattoo of it. Would be better use. So this is the theorem, which is not a theorem yet. We don't have a proof. So we have plenty of such pictures. Let me get back to my talk. Okay, so what I'm going to do now is to make some comments in random order, and then to use the rest of the time explaining where it came from and what we were actually doing. So what we were actually doing was studying the map which is called pentagram map, and which is in the notation which I introduced, the map T12. So simply speaking, you take a polygon in the projective plane, and you connect every vertex to the one after the next. So you draw short diagonals, you intersect the short diagonals, and the intersection points are vertices of a new polygon. So this is a dynamical system, if you wish, on the space of polygons, and we want to study the dynamics of this map. Now, the problem, as stated, doesn't make much sense, because if you literally do this, then this map will contract everything very fast to a point. What makes this problem interesting is that instead of considering polygons as such, we consider equivalence classes of polygons, equivalence classes with respect to projective transformations. So when we do that, when we consider this map on the moduli space of polygons, so equivalence classes of projective transformation, then size doesn't matter anymore, and this map becomes very interesting. And this was introduced and initially studied by Richard Schwartz a long time ago. So the first publication is 1992. Then there were two other papers by Rich, and in particular the last one, 2008, which contained very deep results on this. And then my colleague Valentin Ovseyenko of Lyon, University of Lyon, and myself, we joined. And now there are two more papers, one published and one posted, and hopefully will be published sometime soon. And this is still very much work in progress. I'll say more about this part, because that was our original motivation, and all the configuration theorems which I demonstrated, this is just a byproduct. Now, second remark. I want to say something about pentagons. Pentagons, in a sense, are the most interesting polygons in the projective world, because you don't want to go below 5. All quadrilaterals are the same from a projective point of view. Triangles are, there's only one triangle, of course. But pentagons are already different, and the dimension of the space of pentagons, modular projective transformations, is 2. So it's a substantial variety. And there are three facts about pentagons which I want to mention. First of all, trivial fact that every pentagon is automatically inscribed and circumscribed. This is simply because a conic is defined by 5 points or 5 tangent lines. So for a pentagon to be inscribed or circumscribed is not a restriction. Each one qualifies. The second statement which I want to make is that every pentagon is projectively equivalent to its projective dual. So they're all self-dual. And the third statement is that the pentagram map, which I mentioned in the previous slide, acts as identity on pentagons. So for pentagons, the dynamics is very simple. It's identity. Now, if you want to take something home from this talk, statements 2 and 3, these are nice exercises in projective geometry. I will not tell you how to prove them, but the proofs are one line if you do it right. So, conclusion is that we can easily add pentagons to formulations of these theorems. They all also are related to conics in this same sense, but it's a cheap addition, so I don't do it. I want to mention that pentagons, self-dual pentagons, were studied by Gauss. Their spherical realization, self-polar pentagon. So a pentagon, spherical pentagon, is self-polar if the opposite side to every vertex is the equator corresponding to this vertex as a pole. And Gauss left about 12 pages of computations. He basically computed everything about this self-polar pentagon, and this was published after his death in his collected works, and the paper actually called Pentagramma Merificum. That's the word from the title of my talk. The third remark I want to make is that all formulations, all these eight theorems I mentioned before, they all look the same. So you have some word in symbols from 1 to n, and you consider this map T sub this word, sub W, and you claim that something happens. So in all these formulations, the word W is palindromic. If you read it from left to right, it's the same as if you read it from right to left. And we don't know why it should be so, but a consequence of this property is that each transformation T sub W in the formulations is itself an involution. So all our theorems are self-involutive in this sense. The next remark I want to make is that there is a connection of this activity to another activity into which I was involved several years ago. Namely, Dmitry Fuchs and I wanted to classify projective self-dual polygons. A much more interesting problem of classifying self-dual smooth curves, or maybe curves with singularities, is not solved yet, but there are many interesting examples. But for polygons, it's a dual problem. And one thing which we noticed was that if one has an odd gon, n is odd, and the duality interchanges a vertex with the opposite side, so every odd gon has an opposite, well-defined opposite side to every vertex, then the space, modular space of such self-dual n-gons has dimension n minus 3. That's a statement. But dimension n minus 3 is also the dimension of the modular space of inscribed or circumscribed n-gons. N-gon, which is inscribed into a conic, has n degrees of freedom. Every vertex has 1 degree of freedom. But then you subtract 3, because 3 is the dimension of the group of projective fluences of a conic. It's SL2, PSL2. So the question is it a coincidence that this number n minus 3? Or there is some bijection between a space of self-dual polygons and inscribed or maybe circumscribed polygons? We don't know the answer, but in two cases of our theorems, such bijection exists. So theorem 1-2 can be rephrased as follows. If P is an inscribed heptagon, so here n is 7, then T2 of P, so you draw short diagonals, will be projective self-dual heptagon. And this is not if and only if. So it's an equivalence, it's bijection between class of self-dual projective self-dual heptagons and inscribed heptagons. And likewise, theorem 2 about nonagons, nine-gons, can be rephrased as P is inscribed nonagon if and only if T3 of P is projective self-dual. So here we have this bijection. We conjecture that maybe it continues somehow, but we don't know how. Next remark, I'm a little embarrassed making it, but I must. There is a very cheap way to produce new results by relabeling vertices. We didn't realize it from the very beginning, and so when we did a computer search for all theorems of this kind, we found many more than I presented, but later we realized that they are just relabeling of older ones. So let me illustrate this by one example. Suppose you have a 12-gon, dodecagon, and vertices are labeled 1 through 12, and indexes mod 12. And now we want to cyclically relabel the vertices by sending I to 5i. So this is a permutation. By the way, it's an evolution. If you do it twice, 25 is 1 mod 12. Then, of course, you obtain a new result from the old result, and it looks different. When you look at screen, it takes some time to realize that it's just manifestation of the same result. So the theorem, which was theorem 4.3, the one which was not actually proved yet, can be stated as P is inscribed the decagon, then C131313 of P is also inscribed. And if we apply this permutation, then we get a similar statement with index 5353. Looks different, but it's formal consequence. Finally, and most intriguingly, I want to mention a theorem which was one of the three main theorems in the paper of Schwartz published last year on pentagram map. And this has exactly the same flavor, and we don't know whether it's part of a more general pattern or not. So the theorem can be stated, it's a slightly different formulation, but it's equivalent to his theorem. So if P is a 4-n-gon, which is inscribed into a degenerate conic. Now, degenerate conic is a fancy name for two lines. So for a polygon to be inscribed into two lines, it means that you alternately take points from two lines, and these are vertices of the polygon. And then we apply to this 4-n-gon the following sequence of diagonal transformations. So alternating T1, which is projective duality, and T2, which is drawing short diagonals. And you do it exactly 4n minus 3 times. And the claim is that the resulting 4-n-gon is again inscribed into the degenerate conic, so the vertices are again on two lines. It's an unbelievable theorem, and it has a complicated proof, not one-line proof at all, but it has the same flavor, obviously. Yeah? You start with something inscribed, and you produce by the same kind of iterations something which is again inscribed. And the only difference is that here the conic must be degenerate. So the question is there a non-degenerate version of this theorem? We don't know. Okay, now I want to use the second half of my talk to talk about pentagram map, and I'll try to say as much as I can fit into remaining time. So this is a survey of what we know about this map. First of all, one needs to consider two different spaces. Of course, originally we were thinking about closed polygons, but one needs to extend the space to be able to prove something. And space of closed n-gons, modular projective transformations, this is a space of dimension 2n minus 8, 2n, 2n degrees of freedom for n vertices, minus 8, the dimension of projective group. But we also consider a bigger space of so-called twisted n-gons, which has dimension 8 units bigger, greater. And a twisted polygon is not quite a closed polygon, but rather an infinite sequence of points, vertices, which have the following periodicity property. If you increase the index of the vertex by n, the resulting vertex is not exactly the same, but is related to the same by a fixed projective transformation. So if you move n steps forward, it's the same as applying a fixed projective transformation. So these polygons typically look like spirals, polygonal spirals, of course. So we call this projective transformation monodromy, and this is part of the structure of a twisted n-gon. And the dimension is 2n because now we have this monodromy, so we need to add this 8 back, and we get 2n. Of course, the projective group acts on this twisted polygons as well. This is the formal definition of this action, but it's precisely what you think it is, so I will not read it. And let me present the main theorem. So the main theorem consists of two statements. But morally, what it says is that the pentagram map, so pentagram map, once again, T2 composed with T1. So you simply draw short diagonals, and you take their consecutive intersection points, and that's the set of vertices of the resulting polygon. So the moral of the theorem is that this pentagram map is completely integrable on the space of twisted polygons. We believe it's also true for closed ones, but we don't have a proof. So for twisted polygons, the map is completely integrable. And what it means precisely in our situation is the following. First of all, this map has independent integrals, conserved quantities. And the number of such integrals is this number, twice floor half n plus 2. It's a little bit greater than half the dimension of the space. Dimension is 2n. And these integrals are polynomials in certain coordinate system, which I'll introduce in the next slide. And they are independent, algebraically independent. The second statement is that the space of twisted polygons is actually a Poisson manifold. It has a Poisson structure. You can take brackets of smooth functions, and this bracket endows the space of smooth functions with the structure of Lie algebra. And this Poisson structure is not quite symplectic. It has a little kernel. The kernel has a dimension 2 or 4, depending on whether n is odd or even. And this is invariant under the pentagram map. And the integrals, whose existence is stated in first part, Poisson commute with respect to this bracket. So we're in the situation which is very well understood in completely integrable systems theory. And I will not explain how this goes, but it's a very well understood situation. It's almost a symplectic manifold, and we almost have the right number of integrals. Right now, for symplectic, would be exactly half of the dimension. Here we have a little kernel, so we have a little greater number of integrals that are still independent, and all the consequences, which are known as Arnold-Liouville theorem, apply. The motion is quasi-periodic, and many other things which I don't have time to discuss. I plan to show you a movie of this pentagram map, so maybe I'll make a break here and try to do the movie part. So the question is, how many sides do we want a polygon to have? Don't say 100, but something reasonable. 11? Yeah. Okay. Right. Now the question is, okay, select polygon. 11. Okay. So default it's regular, but we don't want regular. Regular will remain itself forever. Okay, I think I spoiled it enough. Okay, iteration. Go movie, I think that would be. All right. So while you're watching this heartbeat, the picture you are seeing, so this is not projective normalization. In projective normalization is not very pleasant for the eye, because the way it's done, you just fix 4 points and the rest moves. This is a fine parameterization, which is a little bit more pleasing. I'll change this to projective shortly. But it gives you an idea of what's going on. We need some kind of reparamization, because if we do it literally, it will collapse to a point very fast, and we won't see much. Okay, let me change the projective. All right, so this projective, honest reparamization, 4 points are fixed, and the rest moves. Well, you see, it has some kind of quasi-periodic character. If you stare long enough, which we certainly did, you start to see more or less the same motion. All right. You have the idea. By the way, this program makes it possible to change the combinatorial pattern. We can choose different diagonals. And experiment with other maps. But we have results only about the pentagram map. Okay, going back to my talk. All All right, so let me introduce a coordinate system and say something about the map. So how do you characterize a polygonal line or a polygon after projective transformation? There are different ways to do it, and one very convenient coordinate system invented by Rich Schwartz is as follows. So this is a piece of a polygonal line. Construction is local, so I need for this construction only a few vertices near the one I choose. So this vertex number I need vertex number I plus 1, I plus 2, I minus 1, I minus 2. And then we do the following. We extend this side, we extend this side, and on the extension of this side and on the extension of this side, we get 4 points each. So here we have 2 vertices and 2 intersection points. Here we have 2 vertices and 2 intersection points. Now, if you have a quadruple of points on a line, then there is a projective invariant of a quadruple, and this is called cross ratio. And cross ratio doesn't change under projective transformations. There are, I guess, 6 different definitions of cross ratio, and the one we use is this one. It's important which one you choose, and you should stick to what you choose. So that's the definition we choose. We call this corner coordinates. There is a left and right corner coordinates, x, I, and y, I. So x, I is the cross ratio of this point, y, I is cross ratio of this point, and we do it at every vertex. So we get a sequence of numbers, x1, y1, x2, y2, and so on. For twisted polygon, because vertex number I plus n is obtained from vertex number I by projective transformation, this coordinates will be exactly the same. So you can say that what you get is a collection of 2n numbers. This is coordinate system in 2n dimensional spaces. Very convenient coordinate system. And in this coordinates, the map is given by a very explicit formula, which is this. So x means x1 through xn, y means y1 through yn, x star, y star are new coordinates, and this is the formula. You see it's given by rational functions, not complicated at all, but not too simple. And in my opinion, it's quite amazing that such a simple map is actually completely integrable. Anyway, one immediate consequence of this formula is that there is a hidden symmetry, which we didn't see before we write down these formulas. And the symmetry is given by rescaling. Rescaling each x by a certain factor and scaling down each y by the same factor. So we multiply each x by t, we divide each y by the same t. Clearly, if you look at the formulas, wherever you see a product xy doesn't change under this scaling. And here x and x are multiplied by the same factor, here y and y are multiplied by the same factor, so this scaling commutes with the map. That's already a strong indication that there should be some kind of integrability. And this scaling doesn't seem to be geometrical. It acts on the modular space of polygons, but it doesn't act on individual polygons. It appears only after it's factorized by the projective group. At least we don't know how to do it on actual polygons. Now, another consequence of this formula is the existence of some integrals. So these are so-called easy invariants, or more scientifically, they are Casimir functions for the Poisson brackets. These are functions which Poisson commutes everything. So take the product of all x's. Let me get back to the formula. If you multiply all x's, then top and bottom, all numerators and denominators cancel out, and what we get is product of old x's equals product of new x's. So that's an invariant function, product of all x's. Likewise, product of all y's. If n is even, there is a little more room to play the same game. We can take product of all x's with even indices and add product of all x's with odd indices. And again, it follows from the formulas, it's an invariant function. And likewise, we can do it with y. So O for odd, E for even, we get O n E n, O half n E half n when n is divisible by 2. And now the question is where to get the rest of integrals. And the rest is produced by this scaling symmetry. So let's go to the next slide. So monodromy. Monodromy is a projective transformation which we can lift to an actual matrix in S, say, SL3 or GL3. But this lift is not unique. So what we do is we take my drawing, we lift it somehow, we take trace, and now we take trace cubed, we divide by determinant. This quantity, this ratio, doesn't depend on the lift. And Majorana, its conjugacy class, is obviously an invariant of our transformation. So the claim is that if we take this ratio and multiply by this combination of easy invariants, odd n squared en, then what we get is a polynomial in our coordinates x and y. And this polynomial, because of this hidden scaling symmetry, can be decomposed into homogeneous components. So from one invariant, which is on the left, we obtained a whole sequence of invariants just using this scaling symmetry. And also we can repeat the same thing with Majorana inverse, and then we should multiply by O and E squared, and this will give us the second half invariant. So that's the origin invariant. They're all obtained this way. Of course, one needs to prove that they're algebraically independent. This can be done. And Poisson bracket, just for the record, is given by very simple formulas. So X and Y do not interact, they commute. X interacts in a non-trivial way only with its immediate neighbor. So Xi bracket with Xi plus 1 is negative the product. Yi bracket with Yi plus 1 is the product. And the rest is 0. It's a very simple Poisson bracket, but it's invariant, and the integrals Poisson commute, which are two statements which need to be proved. Okay, now, how did we start to think about inscribed polygons? Actually, what we really wanted was to find an analog of this pentagram map in dimension one less. So polygons which are inscribed into real polygons on the real projective line. But real projective line is present in the projective plane as a conic. A conic has a canonical projective structure, and we can use instead polygons which are inscribed or maybe circumscribed about a conic. So we tried to invent some meaningful map which would resemble the pentagram map, and we failed to do so. But this focused our attention on inscribed polygons, and then computer experimentation showed, and there's no doubt it's true, that for any inscribed twisted polygon, each even integral, each even invariant, equals the respective odd one. Now, this is a conjecture. We don't have a proof of this fact. You would think a proof would be easier. So did we, but we still don't have it after a year and more than a year of trying. And of course, this captured our attention, so we started to experiment more and more with inscribed and circumscribed polygons, and that's how we came to all these theorems which I presented. So this is a conjecture, but let me present one result which we know, namely the space of inscribed n-gons as subspace of all n-gons is co-isotropic with respect to the Poisson bracket. So, morally speaking, it's Lagrangian submanifold and symplectic manifold. It's next best situation when the symplectic structure is not given, but Poisson structure is. This leads to an interesting map, which we didn't study yet, but we have a conjecture about this. So the map is very easy to describe in words and not so easy to describe in formulas. That's why I don't show you a formula. We know the formula, but it's not very pleasant. So here's the map. It's a map on periodic n-periodic sequences of real numbers, which are thought of as consecutive cross ratios for a sequence twisted and gone in the projective line. So given a sequence of numbers, xi, we find an n-gon which is inscribed into a conic and whose left corner coordinates are these xi's. And now the map takes this xi's to the right corner invariants, so xi's to yi's. For inscribed polygon, there is a relation between y's and x, given by some rational formulas, which I don't present here. So that's the map. This map, because of this theorem here, is automatically Poisson map. Poisson map with respect to Poisson structure on x's, given by this formula. And we conjecture that this map is actually completely integrable for every n. We check this for n equal to 3, and 3 is already a non-trivial exercise. So we believe it's true always. Okay, now I still have some time, so let me say a few words about continuous limit of this pentagram map. That's an interesting question to ask. So I want to think of an n-gon with very large n, infinite n. So of course, what it is a curve, right? So what is the limit of this pentagram map for curves in the projective plane? So first of all, the curve should be non-degenerate in the sense that it has no inflection points. So the tangency with tangent line is never two tangent. We also consider the twisted curves, which means that a parametric curve gamma of x, if you increase the value of parameter by one, so its period here is one, then the result is not exactly the same point, it's not closed necessarily, but the result is applying a fixed projective summation to gamma of x. So this m is monodromy, it's exactly the same situation as with twisted polygons. So how to work with this curve? This is a much better studied situation. People working on differential equations love this kind of questions. And here's the standard approach. What you do is you lift the curve from real projective plane to the three-dimensional space whose projectivization this plane is. Now, these liftings are not unique, of course, but we can fix non-uniqueness, we can make a canonical choice if we ask this Wronskian determinant made by position vector, velocity vector, and acceleration vector in the lifted curve to be identically one. So this condition determines our lift uniquely, and then for the lifted curve, the third derivative should be a linear combination of position vector, velocity, and acceleration because they make a frame. So we can write gamma triple prime as a combination of gamma prime, gamma, and gamma double prime, but actually gamma double prime will not be present there because of this condition, Wronskian condition. So what we get is this differential equation, and these two functions, u and v, are more or less arbitrary, but they should be periodic. Periodic because of twisted periodicity of our initial curve. And if you apply now a linear transformation to the curve, it will not change the differential equation. So in other words, what I'm saying, the modular space of non-degenerate twisted curves, twisted parameterized curves in RP2 is the same as the space of third order linear differential operators like this, third derivative plus function times third derivative plus function times the density. And with periodic, one periodic coefficient. So that's the space where our pentagram will act. Actually, for technical reasons, it's convenient to rewrite this operator as sum of skew symmetric and symmetric operators, but this is a technicality which I don't want really to discuss. I just want to mention that this new formula, which has u and w instead of u and v in the previous slide, this formula is familiar in projective differential geometry because the meaning of these functions u and v in terms of the curve are, one of them is so-called projective curvature, and another is projective length element. In projective geometry, you can also define curvature and length element, but it's not as transparent as in Euclidean geometry. So anyway, how should we define our map, our limit, continuous limit as n goes to infinity? Here's the picture. So we have our parametric curve. We take a point gamma of x, and we consider two nearby points, gamma of x minus epsilon, gamma of x plus epsilon. We connect them by a line, and what we get is a line which varies with x. So it's a one-parameter family of lines. One-parameter family of lines envelop a new curve here, and this new curve depends on epsilon, and it's also parameterized by the same parameter x. And now we want to consider what happens in the limit as epsilon goes to zero. So instead of thinking, so what I have defined is a flow on the space of curves, right? For infinitesimal epsilon, we have initial curve, and that's the evolving curve, the infinitesimally closed one. it's more convenient to get back to the functions and just to expand the functions u and w, which characterize every curve. So for the new curve, they depend on parameter epsilon, to expand them in Taylor series and epsilon, take the first non-trivial term. It turns out that the first non-trivial term is quadratic, not linear. And so now we define the definition, but motivated by this picture, which is continuous limit of the pentagram map for polygons. So we define a flow on the space of differential operators, or just their coefficients, if you wish. So dot is time parameter, by saying that time derivative of u is that coefficient which appears in front of epsilon squared, and w dot is the coefficient which appears in w in front of epsilon squared. Now, one needs to compute this, and computation yields the answer, so that's the answer. You can get rid of w if you put one prime there and one dot there, and end up with one equation in one function only, and this equation is this equation. And this equation is well known in the theory of completely integrable systems. It's a Boussinesq equation, equation which is well known to be integrable. And so in the limit, we get back to something well understood. So in a sense, this pentagram map, which we have been studying, is a discrete version, discretization, both with respect to time and space, of the Boussinesq equation. And last thing I want to mention is that the continuous limit of the scaling, this mysterious scaling, is very simple in terms of this setup. The function u is preserved, and the function w is just added a constant. So that's the scaling in the limit. Thank you.